your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Okay. Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your childhood reading list. This is John McCoy, your host as always, and this time I have with me a very special guest, Mr. Elliot Kalin.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure and the culmination of a lifetime dream.
Right. Well, you do know, of course, that your brother beat you to this, so I'm sorry about that.
It's okay. I mean, every now and then he's got to have a first. You know, that's just the way it is. After all these many years of defeating him on every field of competition known to humanity, it's about time I get, except for Tecmo Super Bowl for the SNES, it's about time that I gave him something else that he can lord over me.
Okay, well, I suspect that most of my listeners know you, but in case there's anyone out there who doesn't, can you tell people a little bit about yourself and where they might hear you?
Sure. I am nowadays best known for being co-host of the Flophouse podcast with your brother, Dan McCoy. I was the head writer of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart until that show ended, and I wrote a series for Marvel called Spider-Man and the X-Men. That is available now in trade paperback. Go pick it up or order it. And there were a couple things that I'm working on now that I was hoping I would be able to say by name in this podcast, but the contracts have not been signed yet. But there is an audio thing and a TV thing that I'm about to start working on that I'm excited about that people will hopefully be hearing about soon.
Wait, so you're telling me I could have had a scoop?
You could have had an enormous scoop, but the legal teams on both sides have been moving very slowly. So I apologize.
Okay.
It would have been on Mediaite or the Times Media page or something, you know, as reported on Sophomore Lit by John McCoy, but it's unfortunately, alas. Well, the scoop is going to go instead to an email I sent to my parents probably when the contracts are signed.
Let's get into it. This week we are doing George Orwell's Animal Farm. I've had a lot of requests for Orwell, mostly for 1984. But I decided I would do Animal Farm because...
You said nuts to those people.
Exactly. Well, I knew you were going to be on, and I know you're a big history wonk, so mm-hmm. I thought I would choose the Orwell novel that is an allegory for historical events.
Mm-hmm.
I read this in high school. Did you read this in high school?
I read it in high school, but not for a class. There were a couple books that my sister was assigned... I have a twin sister. There's a couple books that my sister was assigned for her classes that I wasn't assigned, but I wanted to read. And this is one that, as a science fiction fan, you grow up kind of hearing about 1984 and Animal Farm and assuming from that George Orwell was a hardcore science fiction writer, which he was not. But I was curious about it. So I did read it at that age, but not for class. But I'm sure at the time, I was like, I know this is in some way about Russia, but I don't know what represents what, you know. Right. And since then, I've been on a long time self-education about the Cold War and Soviet history. So now when I read it, I'm like, oh, this guy represents that guy. Right. But as a high school student, there was really no, I only had the vaguest sense of it as having parallels to real things.
Right. Well, in my high school, we read this as part of the aforementioned class called Workshop of Life, where mm-hmm. we had to read this in a unit on utopian communities, which my professor had us read this and had us read Lord of the Flies. And I think they just wanted to make the point to us that utopian communities never work.
Don't try, kids.
Don't try.
This is as good as life gets. Don't even bother to try to improve things.
Right, and it was a pretty depressing semester. I also think that this was I read this in high school during the height of the Reagan years, mm-hmm. so there was a lot of sort of self-congratulatory nature of people kind of patting themselves on the back about how poorly the Soviet Union was doing. But of course, this book wasn't written at that point. This book was written during that strange window that we don't like to admit, when the United States and the Soviet Union were allies.
Yeah, the Uncle Joe era.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not going to get too much into the backstory of George Orwell, except to say he had an insane life. And anyone who's interested in Orwell should actually take the time to learn his biography, which I had not known much about until I was preparing for this podcast. And then when I pored over it, I said, there's no way I can encapsulate this all at the opening of the show. So I would just say, go to the Wikipedia page and start there. He had a short life, but he was there for sort of the end of colonial British rule, and he saw it all. You know, he grew up in England, but his parents were stationed in Burma. He grew up for a while in England, and then he shunted from school to school, trying to get. By the way, George Orwell is not his real name. His real name is Eric Blair, and
you can see why he changed it, because it's a terrible name.
Exactly.
Like, Eric Blair is like an equally strong name to George Orwell. Like, I know a fair amount about his biography, but I don't know enough to know why he changed the name. But it's like, Eric Blair is a strong name.
Well,
like, it's like Orson Welles used to say, because his name, he could have gone by the name George, and he's like, oh, George Welles. That's a strong name. Like, you could be president with a name like that. Like, Eric Blair and George Orwell are like equally strong names.
Well, he came from a family that was kind of an impoverished gentry. And when he started out as a writer, he wrote these stories about living rough in London and in France. He basically went out slumming and saw how little he could live on, and wrote about the squalor in London and France. And he was afraid that this was going to be embarrassing for his family, so he chose a name that he thought was equally plausible as a pen name, so he would keep his family out of it. But like I said, do look at him up. He had a fascinating life, and he went back to Burma when he couldn't afford school. He became a policeman in Burma, and he wrote a great essay that I once read called Shooting an Elephant, about his time as a policeman in Burma, which is also about shooting an elephant. And I think everyone should read that.
Yeah, that's. I mean, this is not being controversial at all or going out on a limb. That's one of the best essays, I think, that's been written.
Uh-huh.
It's just like, there's so much going on in that essay. And that was one where I read it when I was young. I read that thinking that it was a humorous essay before I read it. There was just something about the title that seemed silly to me. And then reading it, you're like, oh, this is a horribly depressing essay. You know, not depressing, but hard hitting, like very hard hitting, and about a couple of different things dying, among them an elephant. So it was like, I don't know what gave me the idea that it was going to be a funny essay. And afterwards I was like, that was worthwhile. That was not what I thought it was going to be. The same way that in Isaac Asimov's memoirs, he talks about when he was a kid reading The Brothers Karamazov and thinking it was a detective mystery of some kind. Because there is a murder in it, I guess. But go into it eyes open. It's not a comedy essay.
Right. Well, neither is Animal Farm. Let's turn our attentions to Animal Farm. As I said, he Orwell had a career as a journalist and sort of a writer of long nonfiction. He did write some novels before Animal Farm, but Animal Farm was his first smash international success. It's funny, because during most of his life, he was not thought of as a novelist. He was thought of as a journalist and essayist, and he was well respected as such. And then in the midst of World War II, as we mentioned, the Soviet Union and the Allies were working together against Hitler, he was alarmed by the way that international socialists were looking to the Soviet Union as some sort of exemplar of a socialist state, because he saw what Stalin was doing and was just appalled by it. And so he decided to write this novel, Animal Farm.
He was at like an example of something that really doesn't exist anymore, because it doesn't have to exist anymore. The anti-Soviet left, right, where he was very much a leftist, like he believed in a form of democratic socialism, and saw the Soviet Union both as crushing, but also like, if people think that's what this is, it's going to totally discredit everything I believe in. They're going to think that's the only way to do it, or that everyone who believes in socialism believes that Stalinism is okay. And it's shows you this, like, there's this window into this world that doesn't quite exist anymore, except maybe on college campuses, where you have people arguing over what it part of the left or what part of a socialist spectrum they fit into. And it reminds me of, you hear, like, it's the kind of thing old men argue about now, where they're like, whether you were a Trotskyite or a Stalinist or a Leninist, and nowadays they've all just kind of, like, it feels so obsolete because of how history has gone that people have their own types of minor differentiations between political beliefs. But at the time, it was, like, a very specific thing to be like, I'm a socialist, but I'm an anti-Stalinist socialist.
Right. Well, what you say reminded me of a conversation I was having earlier with my wife about the Spanish
Civil War.
Which
one of you was a Trotskyite and which one of you was a Stalinist?
Yes, exactly. That's the way we spend our Sundays, arguing the finer points of Trotskyism. But I was actually talking about the Spanish Civil War and saying that, first of all, I was admitting that I don't know a lot about the Spanish Civil War and that I wish I knew more about it. Orwell, like a lot of intellectuals of the 30s, went and fought in the Spanish Civil War to fight against fascism. And that is a war that I think Americans have no understanding of at all anymore, because it was between socialism and fascism. And today, you know, on Facebook, you get all these stupid little memes that show Hitler and say, guess who was a socialist? Because somehow they think that having socialist in your name
makes you a socialist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I would say, wasn't the whole Spanish Civil War fought between these two ideologies?
I think one of the weird things about the war that's hard for people to wrap their minds around, other than that they're not interested, because they're like, Spanish Civil War, I'm not Spanish, not of interest to me. Like, we had a Civil War, I'll learn about that one, Americans at least, is that fascism won. And right, we think of fascism as something that is, you wipe from the earth. And in the case of the Spanish Civil War, the exact opposite happened. And that government was in control of Spain for many years, you know, long after the Nazis fell. You still had a dictator in charge of Spain, you know, which is a strange thing for people. People kind of have this very simplistic view of the world where it's like, World War II, fascism over, great. Cold War, okay, that's done. Soviet Union over, never going to have a problem with that stuff. Where it's like, those things are, the kind of tendrils that reach out into other parts of the world or other time periods are not easy to deal with, so you just don't think about them.
So Orwell wrote this book in like 43 to 44, and it was published in 45. He had a hard time getting it published because people didn't really want to say much bad about the Soviet Union, because as hard as it is for people today to remember, the Soviet Union kind of won World War II for the Allies, at least against the Germans. And they won it basically through attrition, by sitting there in Stalingrad, now again St. Petersburg, and letting the Nazis throw wave after wave against them and just lose millions of people on both sides. And if that hadn't happened, you know, we like to congratulate ourselves about D-Day, but the war was essentially lost the year before, by when you know, people, a lot of historians like to make the point that Hitler made the same mistake that Napoleon did, which was to go thinking that he could go invade Russia.
Also, they both shot the nose off the Sphinx with a cannon. I'm not going to go as far as you, as to, because I'm not a diehard communist like you are, to,
yes, exactly,
to give them all the credit. But it's true that Russia, in what they still call the Great Patriotic War for the Fatherland,
right,
they, I think that's what they call it, they, like, they absorbed a lot of German bullets, and kind of the worst that Germany had to deal out to anyone who was not on the extermination list and was just on the "we're going to conquer your land" list. And
right,
they were, it's it, like, you could, I totally sympathize with the British publishers who look at Orwell's book and say, even if this is true, this is not the time to print something like this, because we're literally in a war for survival, and we need this alliance more than we need to know that we're allied with bad guys at the moment. You know, it's the, I hate to say that, because you never want to sympathize with people who are closing their eyes to a bad thing, but I, so if I was in at this, if I was Orwell's friend, I would have been like, Eric, because I would be on close enough terms with him that I could call him Eric instead of George. Eric, like, just wait like a year, or maybe wait till the war's over and then print this, because it's just a very vulnerable time right now for England and for the West and for them. You know, like, it's a really good book, Eric, but, like, maybe now's not the time. And he would have been like, oh, you're right, Elliot, you're my best friend, you know, that kind of thing,
right,
probably.
Now, I, lest anyone think I'm a fan of Stalin, I'm in no way a fan of Stalin. I just feel as though, again, nuance is not something that gets taught in America and high schools when it comes to history. And understanding our complicated relationship with the Soviet Union is not something people want to deal with. You know, Stalin was, in fact, a monster, a horrible, horrible monster. But Stalinist Russia did aid us in stopping Hitler. So you have to kind of come to terms with that in some way, I guess.
I think it's that we've passed the window where there was probably a brief window between when the Soviet Union was no longer our outright enemy, and so it was okay for us to look at them a little bit more objectively, and the end of that window when people stopped caring about how World War II happened, when that could have been introduced into education, but I think that window was probably closed by now. People, now the Soviet Union is like, that, whatever, like, that doesn't happen anymore. We don't have one of those. Let's not worry about it.
All right. Okay. So, Animal Farm.
Oh, yeah, we're here to talk about Animal Farm.
Well, Animal Farm is a very short book, so it's fine that we spent a lot of time in the historical background. It's just 10 chapters long and probably about 100 pages.
My copy of it that I have is about 140 pages, but the spacing is very liberal. This is like triple spaced.
Right.
Like, it's this could easily be fit on fewer pages. So I think my first comment about it is, Signet Classics, stop wasting paper.
Right. Well, maybe it's just like it was laid out by a freshman who was used to writing term papers.
I better stretch this thing out, or it's not going to look like a full novel for the professor.
It's fine. Courier font? Sure.
Okay. Takes up space.
Okay. So Animal Farm is a, when it was originally published, it was published with the subtitle A Fairy Story, and it is a story about anthropomorphic animals living on a farm in England.
For a book that is an allegory and a metaphor, the title is not metaphorical at all. It is about a farm full of animals. And one of the things that I forgot about it is that George Orwell really understands the details of running a farm. Like, there's a lot in it where I'm like, oh yeah, that is something you'd have to worry about if you had a farm. Or, like, just describing, he really knows English rural management in a way that if I tried to write something like this, I'd just be BSing farm stuff the whole way, and I wouldn't be able to get into the details that he does. But we haven't talked about what it's about. So
it starts with Manor Farm. It's run by a what's his name? Mr. Jones,
mm-hmm,
a very creative name.
From the Arrested Development song.
Exactly. Right. And he's a drunken farmer. He's pretty bad to the animals, although I suppose a non-drinking farmer would also be pretty bad to the animals. The animals are aware of their lot and wish for a better world. There's an old boar who lives there named Major, who is sort of the, however you want to read it, he's either Karl Marx or he's Lenin.
He's kind of a mix of both.
Right. And he speaks to the animals about their lot in life and points out the unfairness of not having a share in their own labor. And he sees a time when the animals will take control of the farm themselves and will be able to control their own resources and have their own...
And they'll all eat better, they'll all rest more, they'll be working for themselves, and so they'll be able to decide their own lives. They won't have this tyranny of man imposed upon them.
Sure. And anyone who has studied Marxism at all will recognize the basic tenets of Marxism here, of the idea that labor becomes estranged from the product of the labor, that the owners of the capital are the ones who reap the benefit, and you know there's hints of the teleology of Marxism, that there's eventually history is tending towards socialism, and that it's going to come sooner or later. And that actually is kind of an interesting thing, because later when Major dies and the animals are all sort of discussing when the revolution is going to come, some people are arguing, well, why should we work towards this if it's going to happen anyway? And that's exactly the sort of thing that Marxists like to squabble over.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen Hail Caesar, the new Coen Brothers movie, but no. There's a scene where there's a discussion about exactly that, where they're like, oh, well, it's going to happen anyway, but we can hurry it along a little bit.
There's a song they all sing called Beasts of England, which is sort of a... I read somewhere this is a specific parody of a workers' song.
Is it like the International or something?
The International,
like
yeah, right.
Which is a song that I've only read about, but I've never actually heard. So while reading it, I was trying to figure out what the melody was, and only now is it occurring to me that I could have just looked up a YouTube video of the International and been like, oh, that's what it is.
Well, you could have sung it to the tune of Yellow Rose of Texas, the way that you can sing all of Emily Dickinson's songs.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
You know, or what's the other one? You can sing all of Emily Dickinson to the theme to Gilligan's Island.
Really?
Yeah, try it sometime. It works.
I will. I just only recently learned or realized that ABC and Twinkle Twinkle Little Star are essentially the same song. So yeah. I guess there's like four songs.
Yeah, well, so much for copyright. So the animals talk amongst themselves about revolution, but revolution does come quicker than they expect, because one day Jones gets so drunk he forgets to feed the animals. He's sleeping it off, and the animals, starving, kind of wander out of their pens, break into where the feed is kept, start eating it. And when Jones discovers this, he becomes enraged and tries to beat the animals, who turn on him and kick him out, basically. And he's so surprised, he gets just chased off the land. This is all supposed to be sort of, again, an allegory of the way that the Tsar was kicked out of Russia. It was originally over grain disputes, wasn't it?
I think so. It was food for sure.
Right.
And it was one of those things where there were people who were actively plotting it, and then the people ran ahead of the plotters in a way. And then the history of Bolshevism seems to be one of like a group of guys being like, why are we not in control of this thing that we've been talking about all these years? Let's get in control of this. And then taking control and then kind of presenting themselves as having been at the center of it the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the stuff that happens in the book where you got this guy dying and that guy goes after that guy and all sorts of things. I'm not even using, I'm like not even bothering to use their names. This is like, this is a subject I'm very interested in and fairly educated in, though I wouldn't, like, I wouldn't say I'm incredibly educated in it. And yet even I, as an American, I'm like, yeah, there's this dude.
Right,
like,
right.
Trotsky goes over here and Stalin's like, whatever. And
well, again, I would say that the history of the Soviet Union is not an easy one to parse out, partly because the names are all crazy, but mostly because...
Yeah, take that Russian language.
Exactly, but mostly because it's there's not really a straight line you can draw through it. It's not like this happened and this happened and it all happened to the same people. It's like the Bolsheviks are separate from the eventual communist state, and
well, you want to believe that it's like that every revolution follows the kind of American Revolution way of like something happened, the people, a section of the people got angry, they organized in a specific way, some fighting started, and the same people who organized it kind took control right away and then formed things together, and there was a series of meetings where they figured things out. Like, it's a much more, even that story is not as straightforward as it is portrayed, but it's pretty straightforward. But Russian history is so fascinating, like, in general. I mean, I'm a huge fan of reading about Russian history from the, as you know, far, you know, when you starting with the Mongol occupation, and then, you know, like the early czars, and through Ivan the Terrible and Peter the Great and Catherine the Great and up into Nicholas II, and then the Soviet era, but it's like, or the many Soviet eras, but it gets especially complicated with the Soviet era because the things that people are doing are not always rational in the way that you expect them to be. Like the concept of, which they get to in Animal Farm, the concept of like show trials, where you had people who are admitting to things they didn't do, partly because out of fear for their families, but also partly because they believed in a system of government that they didn't want to see disappear, even if it meant they had to fake a crime in order to bolster it. Like, it's a very strange thing. And early on, there's all these, the committee for this and the committee for that. And it's just like, there's so many complicated things. And at the same time, so much of it is stuff that only came out far after the fact, because it was hidden for many years and it was against, you know, you essentially couldn't say anything truthful about Stalin for many years until Khrushchev's secret speech. And even that speech was secret, but then everybody kind of heard about it somehow. It's like, it's a very fascinating world where you have to piece the puzzle together after the fact because very few people had control of all of the information. I remember reading once, there was a thing about, you know what, maybe it was East Germany I'm thinking about, where when, or maybe it was Soviet Russia, when something bad was going on, the TV channels would just cut to this one production of Swan Lake. And so whenever Swan Lake was on TV, people were like, something's happening somewhere. I don't know what. Like, maybe we'll find out about it someday. But this very, it becomes this very strange kind of hall of mirrors that's difficult to figure out. Animal Farm actually does a fairly good job of laying it out. And while reading it as a high schooler, I definitely didn't understand that. But reading it now, I was like, oh, I kind of had the key to decode it, which made it both more and less interesting at the same time. But
sure.
But so the animals overthrow them.
Right, the animals overthrow them. Now there's two pigs that are leading the burgeoning new animal farm. There's Snowball, who represents Trotsky, and there is Napoleon, who represents Stalin. And Snowball is a very good speaker. He's very inspiring to the other animals.
And he's intellectual of the two.
Right, he's the intellectual. And Napoleon is gruff and behind the scenes, and he tends to, at the beginning of the novel, just say no to a lot of Snowball's plans, as seeing them as impractical or just not useful.
Or he just doesn't like that somebody else is coming up with a plan.
Right.
Even if Snowball has an idea and it's successful, Napoleon's not going to get the credit. Snowball's going to get the credit, so better to cut it off at its head so that nothing Snowball says can be successful, and therefore Napoleon never has to worry about losing credit or losing control.
Also, early on, right after the revolution, the animals adopt the seven principles of animalism, which they paint on the side of the barn Anyone who's, again, read this book in high school, this is probably one of the central images of the book, are these rules painted up on the barn, which some of them are like, no animals may walk on 2 feet.
Yeah, they can't wear clothes, they can't drink alcohol, they can't sleep in beds.
They can't kill another animal.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's these seven principles, and it ends with all animals are equal. We also are told at a very early point in the book that Napoleon has taken an interest in four little dogs that have been weaned from their mother, and is going to take them under his education. And of course, you know, it's one of these things where Orwell has tried very hard to set it up as like, oh, this is just an aside, but anyone who's an alert reader will know that there's something up here.
Yeah. There's a lot of the animals in this, and I guess it speaks to human nature more than animal nature, are very dumb for the most part. The pigs are very smart. Most of the animals have trouble learning to read, and whenever any of the pigs tells them something, they're like, that's not what I remember happening. No, you know what? If you say it, then it's probably right. And it's one of the amazing things about the book is seeing scenes where animals are reacting to having lies told to them and doubting themselves more than they doubt the teller, and being like, no, you stupid animals, and then realizing like, oh, but that's what happened. So much of Stalin's rise was telling people, or control, was telling people things that weren't true, and people being like, well, he must know better than me, or well, he's the one in power, so I have to believe it. And it adds this dimension of tragedy to what I assume as a high schooler I read as, these animals are dumb.
Right. Well, we should talk about this maybe at the end when we're kind of giving our feelings of this read through. But I would
final
say
judgments. Let's call them.
Final. No, that's a trademark that I'm not going to cross. the thing I would say about this is I was really aware this time of how poorly the working class animals were portrayed in this book as being so incredibly malleable and so credulous of everything in the face of their oppression. And it bugged me actually quite a bit this time reading through, because the thing about this book is, this book is supposed to be a sort of an intellectual response to Stalinism, it kind of takes a very dim view of the people being oppressed, and I don't know. It's kind of classist in a way, and it kind of surprised me when I went back and read about Orwell's background, because he did spend a lot of time working, living amongst the working classes, and being kind of borderline poor himself, but he suffers from that kind of intellectual disease of sort of looking down on people who don't see things the same way he does.
I think that's true. I think also it's interesting that you say an intellectual response to Stalinism, because this felt more to me like an emotional response. It's a wake-up call. It's him, like, he's trying to say to people, you don't get it, I get it, I'm going to put this in a form you'll understand. And these animals, that's you. Like, you're dumb. And you're not one of the pigs that's ruling. You're one of the animals. If you don't want to be one of those animals, then don't buy into this stuff. Then be alert. It's like he's trying to anger you into not being so docile and not being so credulous. And I don't know if the book ever had that response. I feel like most people's response was either like, huh, animals, or their response was, yeah, I agree. I'm on the same level as you, George Orwell. When I wonder if he meant you to see these animals as an example of, and see, like, in a way, the Soviet people, I guess, I don't know, see them as somewhat culpable in their own oppression because they were so ready to believe or so fearful to believe, and trying to make you angry enough that you don't do that. Because it's the thing that I was going to save this for later, but I'll say now, the thing that always bothers me about when people talk about George Orwell is they talk about 1984 and Animal Farm. 1984 in particular, but Animal Farm too, where they're like, and it's in the like introduction to this copy of Animal Farm that I took out from the library. It's like, of course, this world that Orwell predicts didn't come to pass. He wasn't right about this. And it's like, it's not meant to be a prediction. It's meant to be a warning. He's telling you, wake up. This could happen if you don't pay attention. He's not saying like, guys, put down your dukes. This is what's going to happen. It's the only way. And so I think he's trying to confront you with, I think he is blaming the animals somewhat for their oppression, that if they were not so dim and not so quick to give up the control of their own lives, because it's both easier and less, you can be less afraid that way, or you can not have to fear because you think someone else is taking care of you, that maybe they wouldn't have gotten stuck in this situation. But there probably is a class element to it too. I mean, it is true that like the animals that are the more working and production based, the horses and the chickens and things, are the dumbest. The sheep seem to be totally stupid too, but they like they literally become a tool of the oppressors in the way that the other animals don't. And the dogs are just mindless killing machines. I guess they're all pretty dumb. Like Snowball's right. Really the only one who comes off good in the whole book. Like you, sure. You can tell that he has a sympathy for Trotsky over Stalin. Who wouldn't? But I mean, you can tell he has it just in the names, that Snowball is called Snowball and Napoleon is called Napoleon. Like right. His feelings about all these things are pretty clear, but they're not kind. It's like he doesn't want to see these animals get trodden into the mud, but he doesn't want, he's not going to reach in like with his power as an author and save them in a way right. that he could have. He could have had some ending where spoiler alert, the animals don't overthrow the pigs, but he could have had an ending where that happens and it doesn't happen because he's saying, don't let this happen, you know. This could be you, in the way that old propaganda movies would. Like, oh, a bitter story. Don't let this happen to you, America.
Sure. Okay, so back to the plot here.
This is a very short book. We've taken a very long time. I apologize. Exactly.
No, yes. So among the dumb animals, there is a horse named Boxer, who is one of the main characters, who kind of represents sort of the proletariat. I read a note that said that he was a reference to a very specific movement in the Soviet Union. There was like some worker who set some sort of production record, and he was trotted out as this exemplar for the people, and that Boxer was supposed to represent this specific worker.
There was like a miner, I think, right. It was who did it. But they had like heroes of the working class. They would honor people who had achieved like an amazing coal yield or grain yield or something like that. Yeah.
Right. So, and Snowball is kind of as close as you get to a sympathetic protagonist in this book. There's no one here who you can really point to as a protagonist in this book in a weird way.
I mean, Napoleon.
But, well, yes.
Does people need a strong leader to set them on the right course? That seemed pretty clear.
Right. So, Snowball has this idea that they're going to make a windmill. He figures that by automating a lot of the systems around the farm, they can make the workers more productive, and the workers can have time off to pursue their interests. Napoleon fights this idea, says that it's he actually pees on the plans at one point. And in the meantime, Mr. Jones decides he wants to take the farm back, and he comes to attack with a bunch of farmhands, and Snowball leads some of the animals there in fighting back. Boxer kicks one of the stable boys, thinks he's killed him, but he hasn't. And it becomes this watershed mark where the animals look to the big heroes of this battle, the Battle of the Cowshed, as being sort of national heroes. And they award awards to Snowball and to Boxer for their service. Jump in here if there's anything you want to say about anything. But
nope, keep going.
No. Okay.
Oh, well, this—I think we forgot to mention that the commandments from earlier, they get boiled down to people saying four legs good, two legs bad.
Right.
And by people, I mean animals, because people was the wrong word to use there.
Right.
But it's so every time somebody shows some sort of disagreement, the sheep will start just yelling four legs good, two legs bad, until everybody forgets what was being talked about.
Sure. And so they so let me see here. Where are we at? So anyway, the Snowball decides to announce his plan for the windmill to the assembled populace, and he draws all the animals together into one of these meetings that they have in the barn, where he's going to give his ideas, and then Napoleon can give his ideas, and the animals could decide. So Snowball presents his plans for the windmill, and what Napoleon does is he pulls his dogs out that are now fully grown and sicks them on Snowball and chases Snowball off the farm. And so there's been a sudden coup of Animal Farm, and Napoleon announces that these meetings are now no longer going to happen because they're just a waste of time, that he and the pigs will take it upon themselves to plan the workings of Animal Farm rather than putting this to votes anymore. And one of the first things he decides, actually, is, oh, let's go ahead and build this windmill after all. And his flunky, a pig named Squealer, who kind of represents sort of the propaganda arm of the government, tries to convince all the animals that this was actually Napoleon's idea all along, was to build the windmill.
And that Snowball had been against it all this time.
The other animals are kind of bewildered because, of course, Snowball was, in their eyes, a war hero. But Squealer starts passing around information that Snowball had actually been plotting all along, that he probably was the one who brought the humans back onto the land, that he's been colluding with the farmers, that he's been trying to sabotage everything that they've been doing all along. Now, Trotsky was famously forced out of the Soviet Union and fled, later was assassinated.
In Mexico.
In Mexico. And was Trotsky invoked as a saboteur? Is this this? I don't know enough about Trotsky.
I don't remember if he was specifically invoked. He may have been until he was murdered. But definitely you had this concept of wreckers. They would always say, if something failed to go according to plan, it couldn't be because the plan was not right, or that human labor just couldn't make it possible. It's because a wrecker had gotten involved and sabotaged it in some way. And these people were always either tools of an enemy of Stalin's, or tools of the West, or tools of whoever else Stalin was fighting with at that point. And that eventually led to the show trials, where they would put people on trial for things that never happened, or for sabotage of things that hadn't been sabotaged. But there was this, I don't remember if it was explicitly tied to Trotsky, or if it was just that, well, we have so many enemies, anything that goes wrong is because our enemies are plotting against us. It can't be because we made a mistake, or because we are lying to you or stealing from you. It's because there's saboteurs out there everywhere.
Right.
And so, but I mean, I'd like to believe that that it was tied to Trotsky, if only because I then have an image of Stalin like turning Trotsky into like a monster or a boogeyman or something like that.
Yeah.
And like parents telling kids, like, Trotsky's hiding under your bed, eat all your vegetables. They wouldn't say that. They had no vegetables. They were starving. But, you know, like, but I don't know that that was necessarily the case. I think it was easier for, it was, actually, you know what? I don't know. I'm gonna have to look into that at some point.
There are some neighboring farms. One of the neighboring farms is run by a Mr. Frederick, that they have that Animal Farm announces a brief treaty with. They're going to
they're going to sell them some extra eggs or something.
Right,
or
sell them.
Or no, a lumber. It's like firewood.
Lumber, right. They're going to sell them some lumber. Now, Frederick is seen by most commentators as a stand-in for Hitler, he also made a short-lived treaty only to turn around and attack. And Frederick does attack with some of his hands, and he does a much better job than Mr. Jones did. He is able to bring some blasting powder in and blow up the partially completed windmill.
And in such a way that they can't rebuild it ever again.
Right. And Boxer is wounded in this fight, and he never quite recovers for the rest of the book, but he decides, you know, even wounded, he decides he's going to take it upon himself almost single-handedly to bring all the stones to rebuild the windmill at this point. I'm sure I'm leaving things out. There's a lot of small characters who kind of stand in for one thing or another.
Yeah, there's the horse who can't give up her luxuries and her ribbons and goes off and escapes to another farm. And there's, you know, there's another horse. There's a bunch of horses. Yeah, but right. there's other characters who stand in for different either
right.
individuals or types of people.
Right, there's a trained raven who represents sort of the Orthodox Church.
Yeah.
That he keeps telling at the beginning of the book, he tells the animals that there's this wonderful place that you go when you die, and that makes everything worthwhile. And he's banished at the once the farm is taken over, only to later reappear after Napoleon takes over as a kind of a useful tool for keeping the animals.
In check, that they're like, oh, the, you know, things are maybe bad here, but it'll be better when you die.
Boxer keeps dragging stones, but he eventually collapses at the point, and the other animals take him to be cared for, and he talks to the other animals about how lovely it will be to be retired. And how he will finally learn the full alphabet now that he's retired. And a Boxer has not seen enough police movies to know you never talk about retirement.
No, never, ever.
And he gets carted away by what Napoleon claims to be the
veterinarian.
Veterinarian, but there is one old goat who can read,
or
who sees
a goat
that
or a donkey.
Donkey, right? A donkey. That's right.
He's essentially, I don't know which person he stands for, but there's a donkey in it who is basically just Eeyore. Like, they
right.
basically just brought Eeyore in and made him a character. But he sees on the side of it that it says horse slaughterers. You know,
right.
like, we make glue out of horses! Exclamation point. On the side of the van.
As people may know, I'm a graphic designer. I'd love to have a crack at that logo.
But I was surprised reading it that how blatant what it said on the, like, I think it says the horse slaughterer, and it's like, who would call themselves that? Like, at least call yourself like a horse repurpose technician or something.
WeShootHorses.com.
Don't we?
So, poor Boxer is gone, but the windmill is almost rebuilt, and then at the end of the book we are told that the windmill finally did get built, and there is even another windmill, and the farm is running very smoothly. But at this point the pigs have kind of amassed all the wealth of the farm to themselves. I mean, the other thing we've left out here is that throughout the book the pigs keep breaking the seven commandments, and each time they break a commandment the animals run back to the barn to check to make sure that they are remembering it correctly, and mysteriously someone has written an amendment to it. So for example, after there was the in the book's versions of the show trials, Napoleon brings out a bunch of animals who all claim to have been in one way or another sabotaging work on the farm, and they are just immediately killed by the dogs. And after several animals are slaughtered in this way, the other animals look to the barn to see the commandment that says no animal shall kill another animal, and it says without reason.
The pig starts sleeping in the beds in the house and says, no, the rule says won't sleep on a bed with sheets. Or like they start drinking. Oh, it says here that not to drink liquor to excess. There's always some extra words, and the animals are like, oh, I guess if it's written down, it's true. Like, I don't remember it that well, but okay.
Now, there's this one scene there late in the book, too, where after having done this like three or four times, there is a little bit of weird comedy where the animals all hear a crash, and they come out, they find Squealer lying on the ground in front of the barn with a paintbrush in hand, and all the dogs circle around him and escort him back to the house. And it's kind of an odd...
It's the moment in the book that feels like a scene in like an 80s, like Snobs versus Slobs comedy.
Right.
Where it's like, and it feels like this moment where Orwell's like, okay, if you are so thick that you didn't understand that they're changing the rules, I'm just going to lay it out for you. Squealer is painting new letters onto the barn at night. Now you know. If you can't figure it out now, I can't help you. Go become oppressed, because I can only connect the dots so far for you people. Right. Like, it feels like a very unnecessary scene.
Right. And the donkey at that point, they were told, he nods his head like, oh, I get it. And we're like, yeah, so? Yeah.
I feel like if ever there was a scene in it where Orwell knew this book would be read mainly by high school students, it was that scene where he's like, I'm gonna bring this down to a teenager's level. Let me just explain what's been happening. Right. And also, you're going to think it's funny maybe that a guy with a paint can fell off a ladder.
So anyway, at the end of the book, we arrive at sort of where Orwell saw the Soviet Union being in the mid-40s, with the pigs in absolute control of everything. And also at this point, the pigs start to open up relationships with the neighboring farms. And we've been told, as we've mentioned before, that they sold eggs, that they sold wood. But at the close of the book, the pigs invite all these delegates from neighboring farms over. They have hired a human lawyer or solicitor in England to represent them. The solicitor gives all these speeches saying, you know, it's people thought that when Animal Farm first came around that it was revolutionary, but no, we had no desire to foment revolution in the world. We just want to get along with our neighbors and enjoy, you know, the business as usual. Anything you want to say here about
the well, and before this, we've learned that the pigs have started walking around on two legs.
Oh, right.
And the sheep, who are used to saying four legs good, two legs bad, now they've been taught a new phrase, which is four legs good, two legs better.
Right. And when this happens, the animals are so dumbfounded, there's almost this moment where they're on the verge of revolting, because they can't be fooled that badly. They run back to the farm wall.
Gotta check the barn. Can't think for themselves. Gotta go back and check the barn first.
Right. And the barn has the famous lines, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. And it's a good scene, except that it reads to me now like the end of an EC horror story.
A little bit.
Like, you know, a good Lord Choke moment that they're going to...
There's a little bit, and I like Orwell's writing a lot. And actually, throughout the book, there's some wonderful, like, such wonderfully clear but evocative writing. But at the end, it does feel like he's trying to draw out the tension as far as he can, but unnecessarily so, where you, the reader, have got it. Like, he's not... This is not a horrific. It does feel like a but we were on Earth all along, you know, type thing. When it's not that surprising, and right. it's a rare moment of like just very pulpy melodrama from him. The way he presents that, because it's a powerful change that they've made. But you're like, yeah, I got it. Like the pigs are in charge. Yeah.
Speaking of that, here's the segment from the book this time, which is the famous closing lines of the novel, which I think also illustrate Orwell trying to go a little bit for sort of surreal horror at the end of the book. Okay, and we'll edit it in here.
Just put it in there.
We'll just put it right there.
And here.
Okay.
They had not gone 20 yards when they stopped short. An uproar of voices was coming from the farmhouse. They rushed back and looked through the window again. Yes, a violent quarrel was in progress. There were shoutings, hangings on the table, sharp, suspicious glances, furious denials. The source of the trouble appeared to be that Napoleon and Mr. Pilkington had each played an ace of spades simultaneously. 12 voices were shouting in anger, and they were all alike. No question now what had happened to the faces of the pigs. The creatures outside looked from pig to man, and from man to pig, and from pig to man again. But already it was impossible to say which was which.
I mean, those are lines that, even though he takes one beat too long to get to the end, but the line about looking from person to pig and pig to person, not being able to tell which is a really powerful, it's still a very powerful line, even though there is that good Lord choke aspect of it, if only because it's the visceral understanding on the part of the animals of how totally screwed they are and how badly they've misread things, but also the implication on the flip side of that, that like humans have brought themselves down to the level of animals by being terrible. You know, like nobody comes out well from that comparison. And so it's like, I don't know, it's still like it's a really, even knowing it was coming when I was reading the book, I was, because having read it before, I was like, oh, we're getting to the line where they can't tell the difference between the people and the pigs. And like, it was still like, hit me like a punch, you know?
Sure. Now, let's talk
I like
a
you
little
say
bit.
Sure a lot as yeah, you're I like, do. Yeah, yeah, whatever. Anyway, yeah, moving sure. on. Yeah.
Well, you want me to sigh like Dan?
You just go, okay, well.
Okay, well, sure. Okay, so this book, let's talk about this book as a book for high schoolers. Because when I read this in high school, it seemed to me like it was an easy book for high schoolers insofar as it has a clear message about, oh, this is a bad thing that happened to these animals. And
the writing is very easy to read. This is not James Joyce or like anything where you have to puzzle out the phrases. You're like, all right, this is straightforward.
Right. No, it's the action is clear. I mean, it's beautifully written. As an adult, I'm again moved by Orwell's devotion to plain, mm-hmm. The plain style. And of course, he wrote the famous Politics in the English Language, which is another essay that everyone should read, which is about the importance of writing exactly what you mean and not obscuring it with flowery language. But when I think back to high school, I think about how it engendered very simple-minded responses from the students. I mean, I guess...
Oh, sure.
It's kind of like a little essay machine, you know, you put it out there to the students, and the students can very easily write their 5-paragraph essay in response to it. And I'm sure the internet is littered with these miserable little papers.
Now I feel sorry for them, for the papers.
Right.
Well, and also my wife was telling me how she took an economics class in high school, and they gave them summer reading ahead of time, and Animal Farm was one of the books, and they never then talked about it in the class or gave them any context for it. And so it was like, this story is easy. They'll understand it. But it's to get kind of what's going on and what your reaction to it should be requires a little bit more context. Like it's a good illustration of how a well-meant system can be perverted by ill intentions brought into it, or like how, but I feel like you need to kind of have to puzzle out some of the more nuanced things about it, or else it just becomes, oh yeah, communism's bad.
Right. Well, that's a good point, because in high school, of course, it became, in my classes, the teachers supported the reading by the students that it was a polemic against communism, when in fact this was a polemic against Stalin.
Yes.
Orwell himself was a socialist, as far as I know, for the rest of his life, which was not very long after this. He got to write 1984 a few years later, and then he promptly died of tuberculosis.
I like you say he got to write, like he won a contest. Like he won a write 1984 contest that like the Times of London was, or the Daily Mail was running.
Right. Well, there was one of those little advertisements in the back of a comic book that had a picture of Big Brother, and it said, can you draw this man?
It was Big Brother kicking sand onto a guy at the beach. It's like, I'll show him. I'll write a polemic about what might happen in the future.
Right.
It's called, like, how Johnny became a famous author.
Right. Well, and now, how do you feel about reading it again now as an adult? Did you like it more? Do you like it less?
It falls in this weird position where as an adult, I liked it more, or at least I understood it more, but I felt it was less necessary. You want to read it at an age when you are young enough that you haven't yet thought about these things or formed an opinion about them or aren't fully aware of them, but you need someone to point out what it means. But when you're that young, you probably don't have enough awareness of like world history or events or to puzzle it out. But as an adult, I was like, yeah, I know. I got it. Thanks, EB. Eric Blair again. That's another thing I call him. But also like, it feels like one of those stories that is both of its time and eternal, and that the point it makes is eternal, but the specifics of it are so much of its time that it almost kind of gets in the way. Like I found myself reading it wishing it was like there were fewer direct parallels between the Soviet Russia situation under Stalin and the fight with Trotsky and the book and the pigs and what the animals were doing, because I found myself decoding it rather than absorbing it. Rather than reading it as a moral fable, I started reading it as like, oh yeah, this guy represents this thing. You know, when he gives him the money and it turns out the money isn't good, it's all forged money, that must have been the Hitler-Stalin pact, you know, because then Hitler invaded. Like, I got caught up in the let me figure out what stands for what rather than let me, or maybe it's on me then, and rather than like, what am I trying to get on a larger level from this other than don't trust Stalin, which is a lesson nobody needs to be taught anymore because he's dead, you know?
Right. Well, I the thing I felt was, it seemed very Brechtian to me in so far as it was trying very much to alienate me from the characters. I mean, it was so intellectual, and what happened to the characters was so cruel, but the characters are presented in such a flat, cartoonish way, I couldn't ultimately sympathize with them, mm-hmm. because intellectually they were being presented as a bunch of dolts, and that's not the case when I read, say, 1984. I really do feel horribly for Winston Smith, and it actually makes it kind of a difficult book to read because I ultimately, you know, you're dealing with the utter psychic destruction of a character that you kind of like. But in this case, I didn't really care too much for any of the animals or the humans.
I mean, the humans are all pretty bad. Yeah. And the animals are all pretty dumb. Snowball is like the one positive animal. And Boxer is positive despite his dumbness. Like, Boxer's death was the one where I felt bad because he seemed to represent, and I'm sure Orwell did not mean this, he seemed to represent something much more strangely American in a way. The person who's like, well, if I work hard enough, I'll achieve my dreams. I'm the strong, silent type, and I can't let anyone see any weakness, and I'm just gonna... Like, there was something very, like, John Wayne or Randolph Scott about him, in a way, that I'm sure Orwell didn't intend at all. But at the same time, it's like, He was the one. He was still dumb. He was the one character who like tried to not be dumb and just kept butting up against the boundaries of his own intelligence and just couldn't do it. He was the one character that I really felt bad for. But you're right. Everyone else is there. They're not characters so much as like stand-ins. You know.
Any last words you want to give here?
I'd recommend this book for anyone who is. I feel like I should end it like you would end a book report, right. and then say don't take my word for it. Animal Farm is available at your local library. But strangely enough, it made me want to go back and reread some of Orwell's nonfiction and his essays and read the ones I haven't read, because reading it reminded me like, oh, this guy is such an amazing writer, and he's clearly have such a both intellectual and personal stake in what was happening in the world at the time in regards to socialism and liberalism. And I want to read more of him without this kind of like film of animal metaphor between me and him. But I found myself, I mean, it was a real page turner in the same way sometimes like Margaret Atwood stories can be, or where it's just like, oh, what else? Or Thomas Hardy, where it's like not the actor, but the author, where it's like, oh, what else bad is going to happen to these people? Like, I recently read The Mayor of Casterbridge for the first time, and it's like every chapter something worse happens to somebody, and just when you think they're about to get it, they just don't get it, and something even worse happens to them. And there was something very like weirdly not suspenseful, because you knew only bad things were going to happen, but still this dramatic push of like, how bad is it going to get for these people? Oh, even worse. Okay. I keep calling them people, but they're animals. There's no.
Did you see the 1954 animated version of this?
No, I've actually never seen any of the dramatized versions of it.
Well, you should see it, if only because you'd mentioned earlier that Orwell resisted as an author going in and saving these animals, because basically the 54 film ends with the animals revolting and rising up against Snowball, and it feels so wrong.
I totally believe that, though. The same way that like the 50s version of Red Badge of Courage ends with the hero finding his courage and becoming a war hero. It's like, wait a minute, that's not what this movie is about. They couldn't take that kind of stuff back then. But I can totally understand how this is. There must have been a time when this book felt a little bit like Dynamite, and the implication of it that it was possible that totalitarianism would win, that Stalinism would win, was a real dangerous thing. It's hard not to look back on it the way you look back at anything that's hysterical about what's now a settled matter and be like, don't worry, George, don't worry. But at the same time, it could have gone the other way. You know, if things had gone differently somehow, there's the, it always takes people actually doing things to change a situation. So, I'm torn between like admiration for him for writing it and also this terrible patronizing feeling or this condescending feeling of like, don't worry, it got taken care of. Like, I know you died long before the Cold War ended, but it's totally not an issue anymore, which is the worst way to read anything. Like, you could do that, like, to read anything written in the past and be like, this is not my problem anymore, is a terrible way to look at literature. So I'm kind of mad at myself for feeling that way a little bit about it.
Thanks to Elliot Kalin for joining me. You can hear him on the Flophouse podcast. Speaking of the Flophouse, there's a fan campaign, Rocket Crocodile's Action Squad, which is raising contributions for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. So please consider joining in the fundraising by following the link in the show notes before March 18th. Thanks to Paul Horn for reading the excerpt from the novel. Join Sophomore Lit on Facebook and write me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. And remember, everything will be on the final.